Iran says its talks with remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal should be results-oriented, leading to the removal of all sanctions in a verifiable way. Israeli army bulldozers tear down more Palestinian homes near Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. China urges the U.S. to stop its provocative acts after a group of American congressmen visited Taiwan, boarding a military plane. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran is seeking a good agreement during upcoming talks in Vienna that's aimed at removing sanctions against the country. On a phone call with his French counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that Iran seeks result-oriented negotiations. He says all signatories to the nuclear deal have to abide by their commitments to reach a breakthrough. The top diplomat stressed all anti-Iran measures have to be effectively removed. Amir Abdollahian says that Tehran does not trust the United States, given its recent sanctions against Iran. The Iranian official called for a guarantee for a true U.S. return to the agreement and the removal of sanctions in a verifiable manner. He also noted that the Iranian defense program is a sovereign right, just like that of any other country. Also, Jean-Yves Le Drian said that France supports the return of all signatories to the nuclear agreement. Our Paris correspondent, Rami Mazari, said that there is an international consensus that Western nations weren't committed to the Iran nuclear deal and they failed to offer anything new to revive the landmark accord.
I think that there is a lot of agreement that worldwide, not just in Iran, that the Western signatories have not upheld their part of the deal. I think that's something that really just cannot be denied at all. And here in France, France is usually taking the good cop approach to the bad cop of the U.S., but it's really something that that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, because France is, in my estimation, a bad cop as well, because they have not upheld their end of the deal, and they have really never offered anything significant in terms of actual application over the past 10 years of negotiations. So Iran is now, they're trying to see if the West is going to take it seriously. And what we have out of France today is they're saying that they see talks as having been unchanged since June. So we'll just have to kind of see where that heads from, with the foreign minister, deputy foreign minister of Iran going to Germany and also the UK. I would assume that they are going to say something very similar, and we'll just have to see if they're going to resume talks.
The Iranian army has wrapped up massive maneuvers in the Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, and the north of the Indian Ocean. The military exercise was aimed at boosting coordination among the four branches of the Iranian military. Yusuf Jalali has a report.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a three-day maneuver, codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the four branches of the Iranian army and was held over a million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of their region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, We are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The three-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Israel has demolished three more Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank. The houses located in the village west of the city of Bethlehem were destroyed because Israel says that they were built without a permit. The Palestinian Authority is warning that the Tel Aviv regime could soon move to demolish 20,000 Palestinian homes using the same excuse. The Authority says that the practice of forcing the Palestinians from their homes has political motives. The destructions have become a hallmark of Israeli policy. They're meant to change the demographics in the occupied territories by displacing the Palestinians and making room for more settlements. Another Palestinian prisoner is facing a critical health condition after a prolonged hunger strike in objection to the Israeli jail system. According to Palestinian media, Kayat Fasfus has been refusing to eat for 118 days now. He's among six inmates on lengthy and life-threatening hunger strikes against indefinite detention. Hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees have stopped eating in protest. They also complain about hostile jail conditions, including harassment and torture. The United Nations has expressed grave concerns about the lives of the Palestinian hunger strikers. Administrative detention is illegal under international law, but Israel uses it to lock up Palestinians without any charge or trial indefinitely. Mona Kandil says that the Israeli prison officials have thrown hunger-striking Palestinians into solitary confinement to prevent other inmates from following in their footsteps.
Advocacy groups say that it's not the first time Israeli prison authorities refuse to deal with the prisoners' demands or to end their administrative detention. They only do this when they feel that the hunger-striking prisoners would be on verge of death, and this is what's going on. But the issue doesn't stop here. Their suffering doesn't stop when they end their hunger strike, because the majority of the Palestinian prisoners, after this lengthy hunger strike, they continue to suffer even when they end their hunger strike and they are released by the Israeli regime. But experts are also saying that the Israeli jail authorities don't want other prisoners to follow in the footsteps of the hunger strikers. That's why they are trying to put them in a solitary confinement, or even to continue letting them suffer because they don't want other prisoners to continue engaging in the hunger strike. Several days ago, thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails declared a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with the six Palestinian prisoners who had been on the hunger strike to protest the administrative detention.
China has lashed out at the United States after a group of American congressmen visited Taiwan, boarding a military plane.
We want to solemnly warn the American side to immediately halt the provocative acts and stop all destructive action that will further escalate tension across the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Defense Ministry denounced the visit as a rude interference in its country's internal affairs. The Americans that included four senators and two House representatives touched down in Taipei on Tuesday. China has repeatedly warned the U.S. against sending officials or having formal contacts with Taiwan. Beijing views the island as part of its own territory under the One China principle. COVID-19 casts a larger shadow over Europe. More countries are registering record numbers of deaths, and that raises fears that the continent may be back at the epicenter of the pandemic. In Russia, daily deaths hit a new record. more than 1,200. A steep rise in fatalities reported just a day after nationwide shutdowns were lifted there. More than 39,000 new cases were reported as well. Neighboring Ukraine also logged a record figure of more than 830 deaths in one day, raising the tally to 73,000. Some 90,000 new infections were also registered in the same period there. In Bulgaria, daily fatalities hit a record high of 330 on Tuesday. Bulgaria is Europe's least vaccinated country. Europe is reporting more than half of all new cases worldwide. The New Zealand government's COVID restrictions, including compulsory vaccination, have angered many people. Hours ago, the capital Wellington became the scene of a big protest against those policies. Thousands of people marched on the parliament. They held signs and chanted slogans demanding a return to what they called the pre-pandemic freedoms. Unprecedented security measures were in place, and both entrances of the building were closed off. The government has changed its strategy from lockdowns to mandatory vaccination for all. New Zealand has largely fended off the pandemic with under 8,000 total cases and only 32 deaths. But a new Delta variant has raised concerns with 125 new cases reported on Tuesday. Now, what is it like in Iran? The country has reported 112 COVID deaths, the lowest since the fifth wave of the pandemic hit the country in July. And this pushes the overall death tally to 127,000. Health ministry officials also registered some 8,000 new infections in the past day, raising the caseload to well over 6 million. The coronavirus vaccination campaign is also in full swing across Iran, with health authorities reporting nearly 96 million jabs have been administered. Iran has been witnessing a downward trend in both cases and deaths amid a mass vaccination campaign. Authorities, however, are warning against ignoring health protocols, emphasizing preemptive measures to avoid a sixth wave of the pandemic. Now, in other news, thousands of migrants destined for Europe in search of a better life remain stuck near the Belarusian border with Poland. They have camped out in freezing overnight temperatures as Polish border guards keep blocking their entry into the European Union. Polish authorities are bracing for clashes with the migrants attempting to breach the border fence. Poland and other EU members accuse Belarus of encouraging illegal immigrants from the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Africa to cross the border in retaliation for the bloc's sanctions. Belarus has denied the allegation. Also, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has called on the EU to avoid, quote, double standard in addressing the migration crisis at Belarus-Poland border. The FBI is accused of practicing religious discrimination for its espionage activities against Muslims over the past two decades. Three Muslim plaintiffs have alleged in a lawsuit that their privacy has been violated for years only because of their faith. The U.S. federal agency denies the charge but refuses to provide any corroborative evidence either, citing national security concerns.
The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation is taken to court over a lawsuit by three Muslim men that alleges the agency illegally conducted surveillance on them on the basis of their religion. Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Ali Malik, and Yasser Abdul Rahim, the three plaintiffs in the case, argue that the U.S. government has for years invoked national security to escape accountability over its unconstitutional surveillance operations and deny them the chance to present their evidence to the court. Initially filed in 2011, their case was first dismissed by a lower court in favor of the FBI's assertion that allowing it to move forward would pose a national security risk. The trio appealed the ruling, and a federal appeals court later sided with them, paving the way for the case to land in the high court. The FBI recruited a paid informant to spy on the mosque and other places of worship in the area beginning in 2006. The informant, identified as Craig Monte, had presented himself as a person who wanted to convert to Islam.
They've always, you know, tried to label Muslims as potential terrorists and investigate them, monitor them, looking in, you know, all their most of their privacy has been breached. All these mosques, as we can read and study about, is pretty much, you know, it's open to the FBI to. You know, send in informants, spies, make them feel very uncomfortable and also a lot of them are saying that they feel like second-class citizens or third-class citizens inside their own country.
Pazaga, the lead plaintiff in the case, was also a therapist, said he was furious when he found out that the FBI informant secretly recorded the personal and confidential sessions he had with his patients for a month.
Now, according to the FBI, hate crimes against Muslims in the U.S. increased dramatically following the 9/11 attacks. It indicates hate crimes against Muslims spiked 500% between 2000 and 2009. And that figure has remained high ever since. The measures that the U.S. government took, like the adoption of the so-called Patriot Act, have made matters even worse for the community. 20 years later, activists say that Muslim Americans continue to see the violation of both their civil and constitutional rights.
The surveillance operation in Southern California was part of a broader spying program that the U.S. government enforced after 9/11, using various tactics to monitor Muslim communities in the name of national security.
This is a systematic problem in England, and they want it to be this way. It's been programmed like this by the U.S. It's because they want to install fear in American citizens everywhere, so they can also justify invasions to Muslim countries and to, invade different Muslim countries.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling on the Muslims case by the end of June. Lawyers for the government will argue that the case should be dismissed, as letting it proceed would expose clandestine intelligence operations and harm national security. The FBI has long contended that the information about its informants, methods of surveillance, and who they are monitoring and why should be treated as state secrets. Human rights activists, however, say citing national security concerns is an excuse to avoid admitting that they target people based on their religion. The plaintiffs argue that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, a judge can review the material and order that it be disclosed. They contend that in a case like theirs, the 1978 law supersedes the state secrets privilege, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1950s. Government lawyers' counter-argument is that FISA was not meant for a case where the government certifies that the disclosure would jeopardize national security.
Not all the mosques or all the Muslims are strong enough to file cases and to go head-on with the FBI because the FBIs have their own tactics.
All eyes are on the Supreme Court justices, whose ruling will indicate whether they are willing to protect religious freedoms or if the government has the authority to cover up its illegal activities in the name of national security.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, fear of Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, when we talk about the fear of Allah, the very first thing which we should bear in our minds is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is watching us. He can see us, He knows our intentions, He knows what we do apparently, and He knows what we do hiddenly, or what we hide, the actions that are apparent and the actions that are hidden. So He knows everything, and there is nothing which is hidden from Him. Therefore, we must be careful while performing any actions, while thinking about anything. And when we talk about the actions and the benefits of having the fear of Allah, can we see practically in our life the application of this fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The answer is yes, you can see. For example, if we are working in office, we can see there are many people who do their personal things at work. For example, checking the messages, texting friends, wasting time on Instagram, or the other things. So we can see these actions being performed at the place of work where he was supposed to work. But if this person has the fear of Allah and he knows that if my boss is not watching me, if my colleagues are not watching me, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a complete surveillance upon me, therefore he will not waste his time spending for his personal things. If he is getting paid for a specific amount of time in order to do such a work or such a job, then he will spend his whole time working and for the sake of happiness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of fear of Allah. And we said that at work, when someone is working, he must control his personal desires and having the fear of Allah. And he must know that Allah is watching him. Therefore, when he fears from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he will not commit something which angers Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At work, if I'm getting paid and I'm going to strive for a halal sustenance, halal rizq, it means that the amount of money which I get paid for specific hours, in those hours, I should 100% pay attention towards my work for which I'm getting paid, and not for my personal actions or personal desires, personal deeds. Also, for those who are studying in the school or college, the students, they must study in a way that they are not wasting their time in performing other things. For example, when it is the time to study, they must be present at the school. When the teacher is basically teaching, they must be attentive. When there is a homework, they must do it, because this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants them. At the age when they're going to the school or college or uni, this is the time, this is the age where they must learn something. And this is an obligation on them. learning is an obligation. Why? Because they have paid, their parents have paid fees for that, or even they themselves has paid, and the teacher is spending his time, he's giving his time in order to teach them. Therefore, their duty is to study. So if they have the fear of Allah, they will not waste their time. They will put all their potential, all their attentions towards the studies and not wasting the time. And therefore we see such people who have fear of Allah and they study well, they have reached to the high ranks, they've got high status, and they are enjoying this life and hereafter, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
A simple question.
A British trawler set sail to catch some fish, but instead got caught up in a political dragnet that has also carried the British and the French premiers into heavy weather of their own. And while it may look like a dispute about fishing rights, many believe that the true conflict here is not about trawling the oceans at all, but rather part of the fallout from the politically divisive, emotionally charged and some would say internationally destabilizing decision by the United Kingdom to withdraw from the European Union.
The captain of the Cornelis Gertjan has been accused of acts of unauthorized sea fishing in French maritime salt waters by a third-party vessel to the European Union. While British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss labelled the French completely unreasonable, France responded by pointing angrily at the refusal of Britain to give certain French trawlers fishing rights in British waters. However, a subtext was exposed by the release of French Prime Minister Jean Castex's message to Ursula von der Leyen, that's the President of the European Commission, asking the EU to take further steps in the fishing row in a firm, united and proportional way to show that leaving the EU causes more damage than staying in. The impact has been very public and very damaging. Whitehall officials claimed the French Prime Minister's suggestion had ruined all trust between the UK and France and branded his note a punishment letter. With provocative responses from the French, Anglo-French relations have been described as close to Brexit meltdown, with threats of legal action by both sides and secondary threats such as cutting off the French power supply to the island of Jersey.
What's gone wrong between these two old allies, Britain and France? And how can an argument about a fishing dispute escalate into an international crisis? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this question. How does the public feel about the fact the French, whose embassy in London is here behind me, have seized a British fishing vessel and held it in the port of Le Havre? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they said.
I think it's quite petty in light of everything that's going on in the world. I think if we can't resolve that, what hope have we got with COP26?
I don't know. Now things are changing a lot. I don't know, maybe with the COP26, it's interesting. I like the relationship between the two countries. Very interesting, and we learned a lot in class, in school.
It seems to be a little bit of tit for tat. I mean, I know the whole Brexit, one of the key promises were about the fisheries and being able to have access, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't really think that affects that many people, so to be honest, I don't really care too much.
As you know, the French government is really strict about what they wish to. They really wish to keep their our like fish and stuff for us. So that the most important we see after I'm living in UK since 1 year, so I've seen that with an extra point of view. But I can see that the French government do not wish to leave anything to the UK as far like all the Brexit matter and stuff. So for me, I think it's really important to keep what we own and being stretched in our mind as well about the policies and the difference of ocean that we have between the UK and France. After, I think it's stupid to go on a big beef like it is now and not finding any agreement on anything. I think with more talking and reasoning, it would be easy to find something to do.
I think it's a kind of revenge of not giving the authorization. I mean, from the French perspective, I mean, the Brits have been playing tricky by not giving the authorization that they should get. Mm-hmm. This is a French perspective. So I think it's just a question of showing muscles and seizing the boat, which is supposed not to have any authorization. But this is all about political gesticulations. And you never know what is the truth behind it.
I think the big boys need to get on the table and start talking rather than just having this charade of, missiles flying and everything else. I think they just need to get on the table and talk like adults.
Well, how can they? If it's not theirs, how can they impound it? Like, is that legal? Does it sound right? What can we do about it? It sounds a bit crazy.
I mean, it's just more of the same nonsense. I don't blame the French for it at all. I just think we've kind of really not played our hand very well over Brexit. So that's really what it's about for me.
I think it's political games, and it's a bit of a shame that we can't just come to some agreement between parties.
The British Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary have described French threats as completely unreasonable. But does the public think this is really about fishing rights or something else?
Maybe, probably, yeah. It's making them cold. I don't know, colder than before. I think so.
I certainly think that there is an element of tit for tat with regards to, well, you did this, so therefore we're going to do that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is about protecting industry. In some instances, you know, we've always had this lovely kind of blanket, which is the Common Agricultural Policy, which basically says we'll subsidise so much, and Common Fisheries Policies, which say we'll subsidise so much and effectively take away from other countries that would otherwise benefit. So, you know, you've got countries in Africa, in the Middle East, that simply can't afford it, simply because these two superpowers are having a spat, really. So, yeah, that's my general opinion, that you should do away with the whole kind of common agricultural fisheries policies and all that kind of jazz, just so that you can at least let people earn an honest living, as opposed to it being subsidised, and a lot of these countries then buying their fish, which is naturally produced in their area, from other countries. So, you know, it makes it very difficult.
I think there's a lot more to it, because it's not all about fishing. I think Brexit has 90% of the whole thing behind it. It's not just fishing, because the French tourists can fish anywhere else. I think there's a lot of Brexit underneath. The undercurrent is Brexit itself.
It's a possibility, I suppose. Maybe they're having issues, but how is this going to solve it? Like, that's not going to make us reverse the decision and go back to before Brexit. So I don't really see the point of it, really. It's just going to be a tit for tat then, isn't it? If Britain's then going to do something, and it's just going to be a retaliation all the time. I don't see the point of it, really. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. I don't think it's purely just down to fishing itself.
I think it's a bit deeper. Since all the Brexit stuff, I mean, there's a lot of underlying feeling going on, you can tell. So, yeah, it's a bit more, I reckon.
I think there's a lot of subtext in a lot of these disputes that probably we don't hear about, and I think that it goes way beyond potentially things that are a little bit... Some people may think are trivial or that don't affect the kind of country at large, but it's part of a bigger thing, and I think there's still significant issues post-Brexit, and I think that there's still a lot of tensions to be resolved diplomatically between not only the UK and France, but a lot of EU nations in the UK.
The French and the British haven't got on for a long time, have they, to be honest, over many, many centuries. So, you know, this is all the fallout of Brexit, and albeit, you know, the fishing thing is a very, very small part of our overall sort of GDP and stuff like that. It's something for them to latch onto and flex their muscles post-Brexit.
Well, I know it's political. It's not just about fishing. Brexit has a role to play. I know everyone is quite upset about it, but it shouldn't stop life from going on. It shouldn't stop any of those. And relationships are key to everything that we do. So it's good that we have a good relationship.
The French demanded a €150,000 fine be paid in order to secure the release of this boat. Now, that's far more than this vessel could possibly have earned in the course of this fishing trip. I asked the public why, in their view, the aggression, the dispute, the ultimatums escalated so far and so fast.
I think it's always a case where, you know, I don't really know actually why it's escalated so quickly. I can't really answer that one for you, I'm sorry.
To the best of my knowledge, since hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Mm. Wasn't there like a huge war that lasted 100 years?
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I would think that there's underlying things, and again, I am not involved and have not enough knowledge to have an opinion on what's going on at the moment. But yeah, throughout history there's been issues between, I don't know, neighboring countries.
It's important, like, it goes fast. Like, you know, the fishing beef is ongoing since ages. So now it's getting to the end with the agreement, with the deadline that the French government gave to UK. So I think it's important to handle that quite quickly, for the sake of everyone, either the English fishers or the French fishers, everyone is tired of that situation, even though Boris and Macron met in the COP20. COP26. 27. It's important to handle that beef fast for me.
Because we're running out of time, 6 months from elections, any opportunity for the opponent of Mr. Macron can seize the opportunity to show that he's weak. So he has no time, he's running out of time. And all the candidates are positioning themselves, so any weakness can be really exploited by that. So never forget about the political context in France, which is going to be for the next 6 months very much like tense.
Yeah, that I don't know. It's like most of these stories, you don't actually get to know the background, you just hear the immediateness of it. And so, yeah, and it would be something I'd be interested to find out more about.
Yeah, Macron might be trying to flex his muscles in advance of elections because he's probably feeling a little bit weak and wants to show a bit of bravado, but, potentially.
Too sure. I think the fishermen are very passionate about what they do, so I think that's probably why it's happened so fast, because they care so much about their livelihood.
Yeah, probably he feels a bit isolated. I think that's a point. It felt like everyone was against him in a way, and I guess it's more trying to also show his muscles and trying to portray that we are a strong country and yeah, we can stand by ourselves. But you always need neighbors, you always need relationships and everything.
I can tell. Probably if there is a fight right now, Boris and Macron are there, so they are responsible. But I don't know what happened if it was other people in the lead of the two countries.
I think there's a powder keg that was always waiting to kind of explode with this, in the sense that you've got different countries that have taken different steps with regards to how they've suffered under Brexit, under COVID, and you've also got this other extra issue with regards to AUKUS, isn't it? The I think it's the deal between the US, the UK and Australia for sunbeam production, I think. So that also had a major effect in relation to psyche. And this is as much a political game as it is about fish. I mean, fish are the secondary point here. This is more of it's being used as a pawn.
A quick look at the statistics shows the comparatively small value of the fishing industry to both countries, but the potentially massive economic cost to both sides of this conflict. In 2020, France exported 21 billion euros of goods and services to the UK. The UK exported 27 billion euros in the same year. By contrast, in 2019, the UK's entire fishing industry was worth 1.6 billion euros, and France's was worth 1.4 billion euros. This means that the entire value of both fishing industries put together is worth just 6% of the combined value of trade between the two countries. This suggests it's not about the fish, but about the principle. France and Britain have been old allies and even built the supersonic Concorde aircraft together and started Airbus. So what, in the public's opinion, has gone wrong between these two countries?
I don't know, maybe the two characters, they don't understand each other. Each one wants the best for the country, I don't know.
Exactly, so there was Concorde, there's the Eurotunnel, which is also another huge, huge project between the UK and France. So I really don't know what's happening at the moment. That's what I keep saying, the big boys need to go back on the table, sit down, be mature, iron out all this crazy stuff that's happening, especially at this time of the pandemic and everything else. People need to come together and talk rather than just all this rhetoric about I'm the big boy, you're nothing and everything else.
I think it's a real shame that, you know, the relationship has broken down over, you know, the last couple of years. There's a lot bigger things for us to be focusing on and working on together at the moment. So it's a real shame we can't see eye to eye and get on with it.
I just think that Brexit's had so many knock-on effects, hasn't it, really? So the Condé and the Cordial is no longer there, I don't think. So it's all very sad, all very sad.
I think, you know, the history of Britain and France, you know, only recently have they been working together, you know, probably in the EU, since the era of the EU. I think maybe, you know, we're taking two separate paths now. I think... you know, you have people, I know France are very big proponents of the European Union and they're quite They've got those Eurocrats in not only in France but in Brussels as well. Mm. We're sort of going in a different direction, so it's that old continental divide. You know, we're not on the continent, we don't really have the same values per se as them, so we're just going in two different directions.
You know, it's all about power, I guess. It's whenever you got two big nations that are raised together at one time in their life, in the history. Now, you know, it's about like showing which one can be the biggest. Now there is two different power, France stay in Europe, UK is out. You have to show that UK is still a strong country even though they left Europe. But France is still a big country even though by remaining by Europe. So it's going to be a context like that. After we know that France and UK can stay together, we got like maybe the submarines agreement that could be going on. So you know, it's beefing on the power, but still friend on another one. I don't think it's a lot of matter. It's just on the today's day it's like that, but it could be changed in a couple of years, a couple of times.
Well, I'd like to think that there's something, no damage that's we can't fix and unsustainable. But I'd like to think that also, if you look at the backdrop of the last 2 years and the conversations that we've had as a nation, you know, I think that's led itself to, you know, us looking outwards also, when maybe we should be looking at, ourselves and our own infrastructure and, you know, how we're best set up for the future. Because really, on the eve of Brexit, we had Dominic Raab saying, "I didn't know Dover was so important." So really, you've got to look at the governance behind the country as well. And are we best set up to cope with these kind of structural issues in the short, medium term?
Maybe because they are same, jealous, like who is too close to each other, have competition, like two brothers, like two sisters, I don't know, maybe two same, and the same story, the same relationship with other countries and all that kind of thing, maybe jealous, maybe other fight. Interesting.
Well, some things you get right, and then other things it takes a bit longer to get right. So I hope they work on it.
I think you have to ask Macron. It seems to be down to him causing all this fuss. I don't know if the French people feel the same way as him, but it'd be interesting to get their views.
In 1975, the United Kingdom and Iceland had a dispute about fishing rights. It was called the Cod War, and Iceland won. Can there be a winner between Britain and France this time? And if so, how and why?
I don't think there'll be a winner. I just think it's a whole load of, people trying to show off, basically, for want of a better word, almost like a competition between each other. I think it will just die down. I don't think anything will come of it.
Well, with fighting, as you have described, is going on, I don't think there is ever a winner. Eventually, every fight ends with a sit-down and an agreement. So the sooner they do that, the better for everyone involved, I guess.
In my opinion, it's not about winning or no. It's just about getting the best, the best you can do for your people. So the French government was the best for the French fishers, so such does the UK government for their fishers. So at the end, it's all about what you're going to get at the end. But I'm not sure anyone can win. Just it's gonna be just like who's gonna have the best agreement and people like appear in the country. That's all it's gonna be about.
No, there will be no winner. That's typical of a rule. There's no winner. There's much. It's a lose-lose or a win-win. So we have to find an agreement. Otherwise, it's ridiculous. On that, to me, it's ridiculous. We have to find an agreement, and there will be no winner for sure.
I think they're going to lose both sides, yeah. Because if they enter into a conclusion, which one pushes to one to another, I don't think they're going to win, neither of them.
I don't think you can both be winners. I think we've got to come to a compromise and get on with it.
There's a war mentality in this country always. We like to think of things in that kind of guise. But I really think that if you look at the next kind of few years and the bedding in of Brexit, we've really got to get past that and try and rebuild as a country. And we need our partners to help us do that. So, I'd like to think that obviously Boris and Macron can be on the same page at some point and look at common agreement and what unites us rather than what divides.
I think it's like most relationships, go through a rocky bit and hopefully we'll get it back on track. But, no, it's just not nice to see, is it?
I think, the British at the moment, quite frankly, should be eating more of their own fish rather than exporting it. And maybe this might cause us to try and actually stop selling it all abroad and get it sold over here, which could be a benefit. But I think there's much more iterations to come in this war at the moment.
I think probably both will lose out in the long run. I think both fishermen will always want to get in each other's waters, I think, and so they can never really be a winner.
They lose always. Fight is always a losing game. I don't know, but I don't know what will happen with that boat. I will follow that story.
This is a lose-lose situation. It's not a win-win situation for either. It's a lose-lose situation. I mean, at the end of the day, we're both in Europe. You know, you can't separate Britain from Europe. They're still our biggest trading partner. Actually, it's number one trading partner. And then you've got the Americans, and then you have other trading blocks. So I think the best thing is just to come back on the talk and be mature about it. No one's going to win this one. UK or France, no one's going to win this one. To win is to talk.
Well, yeah, because that fish is obviously going off, so that's going to be a waste of stock. And yeah, there could be other issues. You can't just have that boat sitting there. It's probably stopping other boats from getting out. So, yeah, it's going to have a knock-on effect. It needs to be resolved pronto, really, I think.
In the past, the UK and France have worked closely together. They jointly built the Concorde supersonic airliner, which led to the establishment of the world-beating Airbus aviation business. But with the French president and the British Prime Minister both weathering a very public conflict between the two nations, there is no sign of what used to be called an entente cordiale today. The UK and France have been locked in a bitter standoff about fishing rights. But the true dispute is not about fish at all. After evidence that French politicians want the UK to be punished for leaving the European Union, this has become a very public argument between old allies. And while this will not lead to war, the history of European politics tells us that when two large European nations collide, there are no winners, only degrees of losing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.